It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting, topping the news, Saudi Arabia's king dies. Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah, a longtime U.S. ally in the fight against terrorism and Islamic extremism, has died. He was believed to have been 90 years old and had been ill for a long time. His half-brother, Prince Salman, will succeed him. Salman, thought to be 79, has been crown prince and defense minister since 2012. Michael Fishbach is a professor of history and Middle East expert at Randolph-Macon College. Dr. Fishbach says King Abdullah was a major figure.
The late King Abdullah was certainly one of the most significant Saudi kings in Saudi Arabia's history, going back to 1932 when it was founded. He, like all previous kings, was a son of the founder of Saudi Arabia, King Abdulaziz.
Professor Fishbach of Randolph-Macon College, King Abdullah officially ascended to the throne in 2006. He had been actually ruling since 1995 when his predecessor and half-brother, King Fahd, suffered an incapacitating stroke. President Obama offered his personal condolences and sympathies of the American people to the Saudi people and to the royal family. Yemen's President Abrabo Mansour Hadi says his cabinet have submitted letters of resignation. The move comes amid a political struggle, a tug of war between the president and the Houthi rebels, the militia that have gripped the country since Monday. The Yemen government spokesman in Washington announced the embattled president was stepping down. Speaking from Sana'a Thursday, the UN envoy Jamal Benamar said the political crisis would only be resolved if rival groups honor earlier agreements that all power sharing end the violence. This is VOA News. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says he does not agree with the Iraqi Prime Minister's complaint that the United States has been too slow in providing weapons and training to forces battling Islamic State. Secretary Hagel says Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi should be a little more mindful that there are more than 60 members of the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq. Secretary Hagel says the Pentagon quickly filled every request for missiles the Iraqis made and that other materiel continues to flow into Iraq as what he calls an accelerated rate. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Iraqi ground forces backed by international coalition partners have made significant gains in the fight against the Islamic State militants, including in some cases halting or reversing the group's momentum. But an international meeting Thursday in London, Secretary Kerry said the coalition must keep going.
We have decided there are things we can do more of. We can do better on the cutting off financing. We can do better on the messaging. We can do better with respect to the supplies and other things.
Secretary Kerry described the Islamic State threat as the challenge of our time. White House says President Obama will not meet with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when the Israeli leader visits Washington in early March to speak to a joint meeting of Congress. A National Security Council spokeswoman says all that matter of long-standing practice and principle, the president does not meet with heads of state in close proximity to their elections. Mr. Netanyahu is scheduled to be in Washington March 3rd, 2 weeks ahead of his re-election bid in Israel. At least 13 people were killed Thursday in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk when a trolley bus was hit in an apparent mortar attack. Accusations of blame came from both Ukraine and Russia. Pakistan outlawed two militant groups accused of plotting terrorist attacks in neighboring India and Afghanistan. Ayaz Ghul reports.
In recent days, Pakistan has banned many Islamist groups suspected of supporting terrorist activities. But until Thursday, it was not publicly known. The list included Jamaat-ud-Dawah and the Haqqani Network. Pakistan Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Tasneem Aslam explained the government is bound to take immediate action against any group or individuals designated by the UN Sanction Committee. Since the school attack a month ago, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's government has launched a national action plan to broaden its counter-extremism efforts. Ayaz Gulf, Islamabad.
European Central Bank is launching a new economic stimulus program to boost the 19-nation Eurozone's faltering economy. Central Bank President Mario Draghi says the bank would pump $70 billion a month into the euro currency bloc economy over the next year and a half.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, January 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan rebels called on the African Union to make public a report on the conflict in South Sudan.
We're demanding that the AU and Peace and Security Council discusses this document and makes it public to the whole world, because the report is supposed to handle issues of accountability and justice, national reconciliation, and institutional reform.
That's former South Sudan Vice President and rebel leader Riek Machar. Congo's information minister says President Joseph Kabila has no intention to change the country's constitution. More than 400 people remain trapped in a small enclave in the Central African Republic. And international monitors praise Zambia's electoral commission.
Our mission is actually quite impressed with the performance of the Electoral Commission of Zambia, despite the rainy season, which actually added to the short notice.
Dennis Kadima is the deputy head of the Electoral Institute for Sustainable Democracy in Africa. New Ebola vaccine trials are to start in Africa in about 2 weeks. And mobile technology spurs water connections for a Nairobi slum. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former South Sudan Vice President and rebel leader Riek Machar has called on the African Union to make public the report of the AU's Commission of Inquiry on the South Sudan conflict. Machar says the finding of the AU Commission, headed by former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, will help bring reconciliation and healing to his country. Rights groups have expressed concern that the delay in releasing the report is impacting on the urgent need for accountability for crimes committed in South Sudan. Machar says the agreement signed Tuesday in Arusha, Tanzania, to reunify different factions of the ruling SPLM party will not be effective if the root causes of the conflict are not addressed.
President Obasanjo has reported to the AU's Peace and Security Council. We're demanding that the AU and Peace and Security Council discusses this document and makes it public to the whole world, because the report is supposed to handle issues of accountability and justice, national reconciliation, national healing, and institutional reforms. We have not tackled the issue of leadership. We have asked the Chamacha Mapinduzi to assist us to tackle this issue.
And what is difficult about the issue of leadership that both of you are not able to agree on?
Well, it's best, you know, we take things stage by stage. There will be restructuring of the SPLM, the Politburo. We will have to restructure it first, and then we will have to restructure the General Secretariat. If this is done, in the process, people will build confidence and challenges will be made.
There are some people who are still not taking the news at its face value, because they are saying both of you have reneged on a lot of agreements, so they're not sure what this agreement entails. So what is your message to the international community, especially the United States, that have helped you so much during your struggle for independence?
I don't know where I reneged on an agreement. If you are referring to the cessation of hostilities, the cessation of hostilities is not being respected because of presence of foreign forces. You know, the UPDF is still occupying South Sudan. The four groups of Sudanese rebels that are still in South Sudan fighting alongside the government. I have been raising this issue, and I say this is a violation of the cessation of hostilities.
If there is any assistance that you would need from the international community, especially the United States, what kind of assistance would you ask the United States to give you to achieve this reunification?
They should assist us, enshrine these principles in our constitution, in our practice, in our governance, so that this country becomes stable politically. It is not the time for United States to say they support dictatorships because they maintain stability. It is time for the United States to support democracy, so that people can move forward and create political stability, not through force.
That's former South Sudan Vice President and rebel leader Riek Machar, who was speaking to John Tanza of VOA South Sudan In Focus program. Partial results from Tuesday's presidential election in the Zambia show ruling party candidate Edgar Lungu holding a small lead. The Electoral Commission said results from 90 out of 150 constituencies have been counted so far. Meanwhile, observers from the Electoral Institute for Sustainable Democracy in Africa say they are impressed with the manner in which the Electoral Commission of Zambia administer a transparent and credible January 20th presidential election. Dennis Kadima, the deputy head of the Electoral Institute poll monitoring team, says Zambian voters were peaceful and orderly during the poll in spite of heavy rainfall and initial fears of violence.
Our mission is actually quite impressed with the performance of the Electoral Commission of Zambia, because this was a snap election to put their machinery in place and run elections within 90 days from the death of the late president. And they performed in terms of managing their logistics, despite the rainy season, which actually added to their challenge, to the short notice. So they ran it well, and they also were vetted consulting with the stakeholders, particularly the political parties. They were in touch very regularly, and the accreditation process for observers and monitors was also mostly conducted. They were quite transparent, and this is something that was very visible. They were very transparent, and they are still, as they announced the result, shown a level of transparency and a very high level of professionalism.
How did the voters conduct themselves during polling, during casting their ballot, waiting for the election results to be announced? What was your experience about that?
It was actually clear that the voters were very clear with the electoral model, the voting system, because they've been doing that. They know that, you know, you take the, show your ID card after waiting in the queue, and then you go and cast your ballot in secrecy, and then to the booth, and the ink is put on the finger, and all of that. They know it. They did, to the extent that to some of the polling stations, there was no single spoiled ballot or no single rejected ballot. And in addition to that, the voters were very, very peaceful, very patient, very orderly. It's quite impressive as far as international observers are concerned. We were very impressed.
Nevis Mumba, who is an opposition leader, has come out to concede defeat even before the final outcome of the results of the election. What does this tell you about democracy in Zambia as you've observed it?
First of all, it became very clear that this would be a two-horse race between the candidate of the PF and the candidate of the UPND. And, you know, the divisions within the MMD made things very difficult for them from a very early stage. You know, they spend a lot of time in the court. I think it's a very good move for a country like Zambia trying to consolidate its democratic culture. It actually helped when the person doesn't reject the result of an election. So we congratulate him for that.
Dennis Kadima is the deputy head of the Electoral Institute for Sustainable Democracy in Africa. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotte from Zambia's capital, Lusaka. The Democratic Republic of Congo's information minister says President Joseph Kabila has no intention to amend the country's constitution to stay in power. Lambert Mende said the DRC is not Burkina Faso and President Kabila is not Blaise Compaoré, the former Burkina Faso president who tried to change his country's constitution to remain in power but was forced out of office by protesters. This came as Congo's Senate on Thursday delayed its vote on a proposed electoral law that opponents say would allow President Kabila to stay in office beyond the end of his term in 2016. The senators now say they will vote today, Friday, on the bill. Mende accused the opposition of spreading lies about President Kabila's intentions. He said the government condemns the violent protests.
The violence is something we condemn, and the police is hardly working to stop, because we were waiting for a demonstration and we are witnessing just violence and looting. So the police is busy repressing it, and I think that we succeeded yesterday. The situation has cooled down, and we hope that the situation is now under control.
Of course, Minister, you know that the backdrop of all these protests is this controversial legislation that people say is intended to extend President Joseph Kabila's term in office.
It is not true. They are just repeating what our adversaries in opposition are saying. I'm sure that any intellectual who can read this law will see that there is no link between these sensors that is necessary to dispatch the number of elected people and the time in office of President Kabila. And Kabila himself has said often that the Constitution will strictly be respected. But we are seeing that many people within the opposition are fond of saying lies about President Kabila. And unfortunately, some of our partners do not hear what Kabila is saying.
Is your government concerned about the possibility of a shadow of Burkina Faso happening in your country because of the nature of these protests?
We are not Burkina Faso. They have tried the 19th of January to have a Burkina Faso-style development here in Congo. And I'm sure now that people are, waking up, saying that Congo is not Burkina Faso. President Kabila is not president of Burkina Faso. And our people are not people of Burkina Faso. We intend to respect the constitution. This was not the case in Burkina Faso. So I'm not really believing that the two situations will produce the same result.
Minister, did your government shut down internet sites, text messaging services, and radio stations?
Two radio stations were closed, and the Ministry of Post and Communication closed temporarily internet because these means were being used to spread their violence. But yesterday in the afternoon, we have started resuming these internet and others, and the Commission for Freedom is hardly working for these two radio stations out of more than 60 radio stations working here in Kinshasa.
Lamba Mende is Information Minister for the Democratic Republic of Congo. You are speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 23rd. Daybreak Africa time, 17 and a half minutes past the hour. More than 400 people in Central African Republic remain trapped in a small enclave known as Yaloke. The men, women, and children have been stuck since last April when the country was plunged into chaos after the mostly Muslim Seleka took over the country. In retaliation, anti-Balaka militias sprang up, and since then, the UN has accused the anti-Balaka of ethnic cleansing. Bob McCarthy, the UNICEF emergency chief in Bangui, tells Ricky Stryak that the situation is dire and must be corrected as soon as possible.
You have about 430 people who are there. These are Peul nomadic peoples whose livelihood is rearing and managing their livestock, in particular cattle. They were caught up in the conflict in the country in 2014. And they arrived in Yaloke in late April of 2014. They were over 600 people. Present numbers are about 430, as I said. They remain restricted to one particular site in very poor conditions.
And who's restricting them? Is it the anti-Balaka or the government or the Miska forces or both?
The threat has been really attributed to the violence by the anti-Balaka. That was a reaction to the extremes and atrocities committed by the Seleka and the view of the anti-Balaka that the Peul or some of the Peul populations were somehow allied with the Seleka. So as the rebellion rose against the Seleka in beginning really in early and mid last year and really intensified, Peul, whether they were implicated or not, were caught up in this. Just to emphasize that, Yaloke was not their choice. It was really a point of no recourse, and they were obliged to situate themselves there. There was an immediate humanitarian response from agencies in the field. UNUSCA, or then MISCA, established immediate protection for that population. But they were very much in an environment where the anti-Balaka threat was prevalent, was very much right in their face, frankly. So they have been in that extremely difficult condition, and humanitarian response has been underway since that time. But, as we say, there's a humanitarian approach to this problem, and there's a higher issue involving government and relocation. And we need to see an immediate resolution of this, and we find that their conditions are just unacceptable.
And when you say their conditions are unacceptable, is there a lack of food, a lack of shelter, all of the above?
First of all, about the limitations that they face, their utter reliance on relief assistance, and the fact that, you know, their safety is really imperiled on a daily basis. They, as I said, there is some protection, but there have been incidents. And obviously, in this kind of situation, their physical health, their mental health has deteriorated. They're limited within a compound that is perhaps not larger than, you know, a radius of 300 meters.
Is it the CAR interim government that is not letting them move?
Yes.
That was Bob McCarthy, UNICEF Emergency Chief. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from the Central African Republic capital, Bangui. U.S. officials say new Ebola vaccine and treatment trials are about to begin in West Africa. VOA Steve Baragona reports.
In about 2 weeks, health workers, burial teams, and others at high risk of infection will begin enrolling in a vaccine study in Liberia. The clinical trial will test whether either of two vaccines prevents infection better than a placebo. In approximately 3 weeks, doctors in Liberia also will begin testing the experimental drug ZMapp on infected patients. Anthony Fauci heads the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He noted that several patients received the treatment last year.
However, because the drug was not administered in the context of a clinical trial, it is not possible to determine whether ZMapp actually benefited those patients in whom it was used.
Results from both the vaccine and ZMapp trials are expected 9 months to a year from now. The declining number of Ebola cases in West Africa is good news, but experts say testing drugs and vaccines now becomes harder. Fauci, however, says the tests may still prove useful in the current outbreak,
particularly in the event of a rebound, as well as in future outbreaks, which historically we know have shown to be inevitable.
Also, if the vaccines prove to safely boost a recipient's immune system, that may be enough for U.S. regulators to approve them quickly under rules for special circumstances. The latest World Health Organization figures show the Ebola epidemic has infected more than 21,000 people and that more than 8,600 individuals have died. Steve Baragona, VOA News, Washington.
Kenya's slum residents lack basic services like running water and electricity. But that is changing as the World Bank and the Nairobi City Water and Sewage Company roll out a program to allow residents to pay their water bills by mobile phone. The technology is the first of its kind in East Africa, and it is working to connect piped water to every household in the Kayale slum. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kayale slum. More than 100,000 people live here. For decades, this now deserted public borehole had been the only source of water. But that is changing. The World Bank and Nairobi Water Company 5 years ago began a program to provide clean and cheap water to residents. Thousands of people now have water pipe to their homes, and more are applying for water connections. Veronica Njeri says the connection of water to her house provides many benefits.
The innovative technology of paying the bill through my phone has made my work easier because before I had to queue and sometimes I found the water office closed. Now I check my meter readings and pay my bills.
Those who have pipe water, like Njeri, say it has saved them time and contributed to the general cleanliness and health of their families. The connected residents use their mobile phones to acquire and pay their bills. Mary Mwangi says it is now easy for her to pay her bills without delay.
We use this water for drinking, washing clothes, cleaning houses and utensils. The water is clean. The borehole water, if you drink it, that thirst is still there because the water is salty.
This innovative technology has boosted the confidence of the water authorities to expand the distribution system. The company has incurred losses in the slum areas where there are illegal water connections and consumers are not paying their bills. Vicky Kimayo is in charge of the project in Kayole. She says the water company is finding it easy to operate in areas like this.
I mean, there were illegal connections, people were getting water for free. But right now, of course, they get metered and they pay for the water. So, of course, for the utility, that's a plus. And for us who work in such an informal settlement, we're happy about it.
With more people applying for water connections and high demand for clean water, the company is now facing a challenge to provide all the water that is needed. For now, they are rationing water by dividing the area into zones and giving customers in each zone just a few hours to fill their containers. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting, here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on the Orange Africa Cup of Nations in Equatorial Guinea. Emmanuel Mayuka scored in the 59th minute for Zambia before Tunisia's Ahmed Akaishi equalized for Tunisia in the 70th minute. Akaishi is the first player to score twice in this year's Nations Cup. Then captain Yassine Chikawi headed home across in the 89th minute to hand Tunisia a 2-1 triumph over Zambia in Ebedien on Thursday. Then Cape Verde Islands and the Democratic Republic of Congo played to a scoreless draw. Consequently, Tunisia lead the group with 4 points. Cape Verde Islands and the Democratic Republic of Congo are tied in second place with 2 points each, while Zambia has 1 point. In Mongomo, Ghana challenge Algeria, then South Africa face Senegal in Group C matches today, Friday. Algeria and Senegal have 3 points each, having won their first group ties. However, Algeria topped the group on account of a better goal average. Ghana is third ahead of South Africa. Elsewhere, Ivory Coast engage Mali, then Cameroon play Guinea in Group D ties in the capital Malabo tomorrow, Saturday. All teams are leveled, having played to an identical 1-1 draw in their opening round of their campaign. Meanwhile, action reverts back to Group A on Sunday. Republic of Congo take on Burkina Faso in Ebedien, while hosts Equatorial Guinea engage Gabon in a Central African derby in Bata. Going into these fixtures, the Congolese lead the group with 4 points. Gabon has 3, Equatorial Guinea 2, and Burkina Faso 1. Finally, the hosts for the 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations will be named on the 8th of April, the Confederation of African Football revealed in Cairo, Egypt on Thursday. For the first time, the host nation will compete in the qualifiers. However, their matches will not be computed as points, but treated as friendlies to give the host nation match practice. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning. Our listener mail for this Friday morning comes from Black Star Deng Bo Deng of Juba, South Sudan. He says, "Dear VOA, I would like to urge President Joseph Kabila of the Democratic Republic of Congo to step down before things become worse. Why do African leaders like to die in office and nobody seems to care? It is a shameful thing that Africa lacks a history of good governance apart from the late Nelson Mandela and Kofi Annan." We thank you, Black Star Deng Bog Den of Juba, South Sudan, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Partial results from Zambia's presidential election show ruling party candidate Edgar Lungu holding a small lead. The tally released by Zambia's Electoral Commission on Thursday shows Lungu of the Patriotic Front Party winning just under 51% of the vote. That is it for this Friday, January 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer James Harmon, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you a very good weekend.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the Internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Zambians have elected their next president following the sudden death of Michael Sata. We'll discuss the results and the copper-producing nation's future next time on VOA Africa.